Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the speaker tonight. I'm going to talk about tax policies to die for. We welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit the Commonwealth Club at www.commonwealthclub.org. Tax policies to die for. Thought of this lecture title because, as some of you know, the estate tax disappeared this year. How many are aware of that? There's no estate tax this year. Yeah. So what that means is that if you die during 2010, your estate will not be taxed. Now, why did that come about? And it's, I think, a very good example of the unintended consequences of policies, tax policies in this case, in which case you have been given an incentive to die this year if you have an estate. That was not the intention, but it's the reality. So why did that happen? In 2001, 2002, the Bush budget looked ahead, wanted to get rid of the estate tax altogether. And so they increased every year the threshold. I think it started at about $1 million at the time. And every year the threshold, you could deduct, I mean, in other words, it was not subject to tax if your estate was under that amount. It used to be $1 million in 2001. It went all the way up to about $3.5 million. Is that about right, Charlie? Yeah, $3.5 million last year. And then this year, it disappeared completely. That was all planned in the bill that was passed in 2001, 2002. But what were they thinking? Well, first of all, it was George W. Bush administration. And when they present their tax policies, when they present their tax program, they have to project, and then the Congressional Budget Office does a checkup of how much this is going to cost the federal government over a period of time. So getting rid of the estate tax is going to cost money. Well, they didn't want deficits projected out into the future, you know, that would look bad for them. And so they made it go back in at $1 million threshold, or maybe $2 million threshold. I think they think it's a little bit different, but at a lower threshold in 2011. That way they didn't have to project 10 years ago that the deficits would continue on from this action on their part for the next 10 years. So it made it look better than it actually was. But they all thought, you know, people are not going to let this happen. Congress will not let this happen. They will not let the law disappear and then pop back in the next year. And last year there was a lot of discussion about not letting this happen. We can't let this happen, but there were plenty of other things on their plate, and they let this happen. So now, because of the budget process that made their budgets look better than they actually were, something that almost everybody who runs an organization is familiar with, that if you... That was the incentive. That was the reason for it. But the incentive now is that if you die before the end of this year, your estate is more than you know, a few million dollars, your descendants are going to inherit more money if you die this year than if you die next year. Now, if that's a lot of money, like $50 million, that could mean $20 million, $25 million in taxes saved by your relatives if you die before the end of the year. So I predict that by the end of this year, there will be plenty of stories in the media about, you know, not necessarily killings of relatives, but threats to kill relatives. Or couldn't you please die before the end of the year? I mean, you're really awfully sick. Could you please die in December? Because it could mean a difference of millions and millions of dollars to people. Now, it's not wise, as is obvious, to have incentives in your tax code like that. That's not really, I mean, if you're trying to manipulate social behavior, well, that certainly might do it, but that's not exactly, you know, the attempt that you should make for manipulating social behavior. So when I thought that they were changing. Now, why haven't they changed? They thought about changing it, but there's actually a financial reason why they didn't change it either. What they didn't stop to think of when they were thinking that they were going to lose all this revenue was that there's another part of the inheritance tax code, which costs the federal government money, which is that there's a step-up in basis for all the assets that you inherit. I'll explain that. Your grandmother, who's about to die, bought stock of AT&T for $5 each 50 years ago, and it's now worth $200 each, and so there's $195 of value increase per share of stock. You're going to inherit all that. Now, under the inheritance tax code, you get the value on her date of death. There's other details, but we won't go into that. you get the value on her date of death, and therefore you get the value at $200, and you're not taxed unless the stock goes over that. In fact, you can take a loss on the stock if it goes down below that. All right. But if there's no inheritance tax law, then if you sell that stock, your basis is $5, just what she paid for it all those years ago. So they're going to be able to collect the taxes when people sell assets that they've inherited, even if there's no, you know, inheritance tax this year. And so they realize that they probably would make quite a bit of money on that. It might make up for it. We have other things to do. Let's just forget about it and make, you know, and I think it's partially the Democrats trying to make the Republicans look bad for having done this in the first place. So all those things involved, it looked like there was a big push to get this done before the end of last year. Didn't happen. It's gone over into this year. Don't think it'll ever happen. I think that they'll automatically allow the tax code to come back in again at a lower rate next year, and then the inheritance tax will be right back in place. In the meantime, lots of strange incentives took place. So I'm going to talk about incentives in the tax code and why we really ought not to do things that way. Not that we will stop. We'll continue to do things the way we ought not to. That's a given. But it's very interesting to think about what ways we could do things that would be more rational. So one thing I want to look ahead and project why this is going to be a problem. It might not be a problem right now, but there's going to be a problem coming up in the future, and that's the demographic change that most people are hoping for. The demographic change is that everybody is saying, if we are going to have enough resources on this planet for the human race, we're not going to mention the other races, but for the human race, if we're going to have enough resources, then what we need to do is have the humanity stop reproducing at such a high rate and, you know, cut back and so on and so forth, get down to 2 children per family and so on and so forth, so that we reach a level of sustainability. Now, the people who believe in this and hope that it will happen think that we'll reach that in about 2050. It'll be about 9 to 10 billion people then, and then we'll just stay there. Maybe there'll be dips down and dips up, but we're going to just stay there. Now, that probably won't happen either, but that's what people are hoping for. Now, if that happens, if that hope is realized, what will the consequence of that be? What will the economic and financial consequence of that hoped-for dream be? It's a big change, because almost every institution relies on fast growth or quite a bit of growth to hide all their inefficiencies, to hide all their inadequacies. That's why people don't like recessions. It kind of reveals, as Warren Buffett says, you know, when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming without a bathing suit. And basically, you know, if we get our goal, our achievement of having no growth in the human race, then we're going to find out all the inadequacies of how we do things, and, you know, a lot more than just in a recession. And that will be a crunch time for how people will deal with things. Now, it's not all necessarily bad. If there were fewer people, you know, if for some reason the race reduced itself. Well, we have a few experiences of that, the main one being the Black Death in the Middle Ages. And the result of the Black Death killing one-third of the population was that suddenly people had a lot of power for their wages. You know, a lot of people, workers, had power to negotiate higher wages because a lot of work needed to get done and there weren't enough people to do it. And so wages, the middle class was created. All kinds of things shifted. But one of the things that also shifted was that there was more housing stock than was needed because there weren't so many people left. As a result of which, either they were left to deteriorate or the worst of the stock were ripped out, you know, pulled down, and people lived in slightly better housing than they had before. So there are advantages to having 10 billion people on the planet and then going back to 8 billion. However, you know, how we do this is going to make a big, big difference in how comfortable this change is going to be. Now, about 10 years ago when I came out to California, I met a woman. I won't tell you which environmental organization she was with, but it was with one of the environmental organizations. And she was very, very afraid of the future for the human race and that there wasn't going to be enough resources and everything. I didn't tell her I had 11 siblings or she probably wouldn't have talked to me. She said that the human race, really the planet, could only handle about 1 billion of us. That anything more than a billion was a recipe for disaster, and that we had to figure out some way to get back to a billion. And I said, okay, what's your plan for getting us from 5.5 to 6 billion people back to a billion? What's your plan? Because I can tell you, A few people tried a little bit of that in the 20th century. They're not very popular people. Hitler, you know, Mao Zedong, Stalin, each, you know, made a small dent, you know, 20, 30, 40 million people. That's all they could handle. And they worked at it pretty hard. So you're talking about 5 billion. I don't think you're going to be very popular if you actually, you know, present a program for this. So, you know, we just have to work with reality. What is there? We've got 6 billion people. What are we going to do about it? Well, she wasn't too happy about that because she hadn't thought of that before. I was a little surprised. But she hadn't thought about what's the process to get from here to there. And that's something we don't do. We have hopes. We have dreams. We have this dream to cut off at 9 or 10 billion people, you know, and stay there. But we don't think about what that's going to cost us in a lot of different ways. So one of the things about that demographic change is that we have to plan ahead. What will it be like to have a low-growth economy or a no-growth economy or even an economy that is decreasing? Our GDP is decreasing because we'll have fewer people. We might even be more productive per person still, but we will have smaller and smaller economies. That could happen. We haven't thought about that. Nobody talks about that, but that will be a really big, and the chances of us having high-growth economies continues to decrease as the population ages and we have fewer and fewer young people because we're cutting back on the number of children. Because the cycle of economic spending and what you do with your money changes dramatically, and it's people put all their money and resources into getting in their first house and buying their furniture and all that kind of stuff, and most people who are 55 or older either are never going to have that or have that already. And therefore, a population where a large percentage of the population is over 55 or in retirement age has a totally different consumption pattern and doesn't contribute to high growth economic activity. So we are already moving in that direction. And if you look at Japan for the last two decades, that's a very large part of what happened. There's a lot of talk about, well, they didn't do things right when they had a recession with the banks. Their bank policy was a little bit off and everything. But the biggest factor of all, and it's sometimes stated but not that often, the biggest factor is they have an aging population without a lot of replacement. And as a result, their economy has gone sideways for almost two decades now. But if you look at that, you also, if you go to Japan and travel, it's a wealthy society. They haven't been growing, but it's a wealthy society. People live well. The only thing they don't have is a lot of land and a lot of real estate space, but that's the problem of living on an island with 100 million people. So in general, going sideways doesn't mean that you have a bad economy. So that's another factor. But we have to think about this because those two factors are going to clash with each other. So what does this have to do with tax policy? Well, our tax policies influence all of our economic behavior. And I want to talk about how to simplify what we're doing. First thing I wanted to mention about that is there was a French finance minister, Jean-Baptiste Colbert. It was the original Colbert Report. And he was the finance minister to the French kings. And one of his famous sayings, he had a few, but one of his famous sayings about taxation was that the art of taxation lies in plucking the largest number of feathers from the goose with the least amount of hissing. And that's basically the way a monarchy goes about collecting taxes. Where can we hide all of our taxes so that people hardly notice, you know, as they walk down the street, we picked something here, we picked something there, and picked something here, picked something there, all the way down the street. And this is what our country does too, and what all democracies do too. And I think, in general, we have not figured out that we're a democracy. It's only been 300 years. So, since democracy started to really push forward, and it's still an experiment, I suppose, but at this point, we ought to catch on that we don't have to do things the way that monarchies and aristocratic governments have done it, which is you have to fool the people most of the time. Now, still be fooling the people most of the time, but if you have transparency and efficiency in the tax policies, that should work much better in a democratic system, and you might be able to get the people to be in favor of it. So that's one principle that I think we need to learn. The reason that I don't think that we've learned that is I don't really think that we believe in democracy. When we think about it, we say we like democracy, we think it's the best thing, and we kind of, you know, quote Churchill and say, well, yeah, it's a really bad system, but it's not. All the others are worse. But we don't believe it emotionally. And my example actually comes from this room. I gave a talk right after the election in 2004, in November, called Do We Really Believe in Democracy? And my first question was very simple, and I'll talk about it now. How many people have from the 2008 election, you have to go back a little bit, but how many people had a strong emotional reaction to the 2008 election? Almost everybody, okay? And people had, how many people were delighted at the result of the election? Okay? And how many people were furious at the result of the election? Okay? Now, in 2004, when I asked this question at the lecture, it was exactly the opposite. You know, there were only a few people that were delighted. I mean, this is San Francisco, after all. There were only a few people that were delighted with the election, and a lot of people were very, very upset. So now, how many people had this emotional reaction to either the 2004 or the 2008 election? Their man that they voted for lost, but they felt happy inside because the majority will got its way. You all look blank. Why would anybody feel that way, right? But if you believed in democracy, that's how you'd feel. You'd feel that the majority should get their way. You should be happy that the majority gets their way because that's what democracy is for. That's why I say that emotionally we give ourselves away. We're not Democrats. Almost nobody is a Democrat. Everybody would like the majority to vote in favor of whatever they want done. And we do think of things as an aristocracy, as a monarch, but with ourselves as the monarch. That's the way we treat life. In general, one of the things that's very interesting is that almost everyone assumes that they're the center of the universe. Now, you see this really clearly in children, and people modify it over time. But in children, children always assume that they're the center of the universe. And I have the people who seem to keep this two-year-old attitude longest are politicians and Hollywood stars. When they walk into a room, they want everybody to jump up and, oh, look, Sammy's here. Because that's what happened when they were 2 years old. You know, you walk in a room and you're 2 years old, your family's still so happy with you that they're delighted every time you walk in the room and everybody's going, Jerry, Sammy's here, Sammy's his birthday or it's whatever. And, you know, people miss that adulation. And those who don't get over it have to find it some other way. Now, we find it in lots of smaller ways, but I think that the people who really don't get over it have to go into politics or the movies in order to get it. So my point is we really don't believe in democracy emotionally. We don't treat life that way. And the sign of maturity is to realize that you're one of billions of people, and we know exactly how many people are mature. So that element we also kind of should think about too. So now I'll get to that's the fundamental ideational background behind my ideas. What could we do to simplify our tax policies? What could we do to make policies straightforward, democratic, and efficient, and take care of the policies that we are interested in? First thing is we could simplify through elimination. The first thing that I suggest we eliminate is probably one of the most outrageous ideas from lots of people's point of view until they hear about it. I think that the corporate income tax should be eliminated. Why should the corporate income tax be eliminated? If you took a poll right now on the internet or almost anywhere and said, should we tax big corporations more, less, or not at all? It would be at least 99% more. And almost nobody would say not at all. But what is the corporate income tax? In reality, what is it? It is a hidden sales tax. Whatever is paid by the corporations in tax, I mean, they're very good at getting around it, but whatever is paid increases the cost of their goods and services to everybody else, which is exactly what a sales tax is. And therefore, it makes no difference to the corporation from a bottom line point of view, whether there's an income tax or not. It makes a strategic difference to them, though. But it doesn't make a bottom line difference. They know what they're aiming for in terms of profits. They set their prices based on that. They know what they're going to have to pay in taxes. Now, they're not perfect at it. I mean, but let me say, and I know some people in this room who have done this, a lot of very intelligent talent has gone into the process of keeping the corporations from paying higher taxes. People who advise the corporations, people who get the ear of the government to change the rules a little bit this way and a little bit that way that allow the corporations to get a little bit less to pay taxes. Because if it's millions and millions of dollars on their bottom line, they're going to want to influence that, right? Okay. Now, so what does this hidden sales tax do? First of all, it redirects the intelligent energies of 300,000 to 500,000, if not a million people, every year, and all their energy is involved in eliminating those taxes for those big corporations or small corporations or any corporation, right? And or all the nonprofits, all everybody is being advised by large numbers of people because of these tax, because of a hidden sales tax, right? And all that energy, all that intellectual, and this is not, you know, this is high-paid work, and it is high-skilled work, and we are using all those people to do something which would be totally unnecessary if we didn't have a hidden sales tax. What else happens? The corporations move their money abroad because they don't want to be taxed here. They move their profits abroad because they don't want to be taxed here. They find whatever the lowest tax place is to have it. There's a movement of profits here, a movement of expenses here, and so on and so forth. Why? To avoid those taxes. It's a sales tax, and it creates all kinds of otherwise uneconomic decisions because you're trying to avoid the tax. In addition to that, how many lobbyists are in Washington full-time being paid? How much of the campaign contributions that keep raising the cost of running for government are all based upon a hidden sales tax that doesn't make any sense? Now, I say all that, it sounds like absolutely idiotic that we do it that way. But I can almost guarantee, no matter how many times you could explain it in that short three points, five sentences, you know, 5 minutes, that explanation could be repeated for the next 100 years, and the corporate income tax will still be there because it is something that people can hold up and say, you know, this is something that we really have to get those big corporations. Well, those big corporations really get us as a result of that because they have much more influence. Do you think the corporations would be really interested in what's going on in Washington if it didn't matter to them economically? No. No. You'd still need regulations. You'd still have to have a relationship between the federal government and the corporations that do all the things. You need to make sure that they don't pollute. There's things that need to be done, no question. You can't just set them free. But absolutely idiotic to make them 10 or 100 times more interested in what's going on in Washington than they need to be, because when they're interested, they pay attention. When they pay attention with money, and it influences everything that happens. So that's the first thing that I would get rid of. The second thing is the Social Security tax. Social Security tax is the most regressive tax that we have. It has a nice name. It's a nice program. It's very important. But why do we raise the money for it that way? We raise it on the first money that everybody makes. It's 15 to 16% when you get the Medicare and everything. What is it, 12.65 plus 2.95? It's 15.3%, something like that. So more people, did you know that half the people in our country pay no income tax, but pay plenty of Social Security tax? The poorest people, they pay plenty in Social Security, but they don't pay any income tax because they don't have enough income to justify that, because it's all on the money. So the Social Security tax, great reputation, one of the most regressive taxes that we have. So I guess you can fool a lot of the people a lot of the time, because the public appreciation of those two taxes is exactly the opposite of what it should be. Next thing is the inheritance tax. I talked a little bit about it, what's going on with it. This is a little bit more of an ambiguous situation. There was a reason until fairly recently to make sure that no family got too much wealth, because when some families concentrated their wealth so strongly, they ended up becoming the king in a country, right? And they ran the country. And certainly rich families have had strong influences over the government of countries for all of recorded history. But our big corporations that we hate so much have outweighed that. Their influence far outweighs what any family can do. And therefore, we really don't need to try to rein in the richest families anymore. I think that would be an experiment. But I think you could find 100 years of not taxing the as even they found out this year, they still would have to pay on all the income that they get from their assets and everything. So probably the amount of money coming into the treasury would be very little different. But it would put an end in principle to the taxation of assets, to take away assets from people instead of, so that you don't really know, can they afford those assets to go away or not? Is it the family farm? Is it this? Is it the small business and so on? And that's what's being taken away from people? If you don't tax people's assets, you don't ever have to worry about that if you only tax the income. So on balance, I think that that's one thing. And then the other thing, that, you know, the worry about the rich families, you know, is pretty clear. But I think you can count on the third and fourth and fifth generations of most rich families to redistribute all the wealth to hedge funds and lawyers and vineyards and all the other things that, you know, very rich people who don't who've been rich their whole lives have spent their money on. It's not that gets, you know, that's also very good economic activity. It's very good economic activity for everybody around. But you don't, these generations, I mean, it happens in corporations too, whether it's a family or not. The corporations, third or fourth generation, the leaders of the corporations, have a tough time keeping the corporation going too, the organization going too, because they don't have the vision, they have a different attitude towards different things than the people who founded it and got it going and got it built up. So another thing. Now, another thing that can be eliminated. The other thing that I would do is eliminate all of the ways that we redistribute money now, unemployment, welfare, Social Security, etc. And I would eliminate the minimum wage too. And what would replace that? This five-sentence tax code. First sentence is, the Congress shall annually set a break-even point for the taxation of income of individuals every year for the following year. Second sentence, any individual whose income equals the break-even point shall pay no tax and receive no subsidy. Third sentence, any individual whose income exceeds the break-even point shall pay 40% of the excess as an income tax. Fourth sentence, any individual whose income is less than the break-even point shall receive a subsidy of 40% of the discrepancy between what they earn and the break-even point. The fifth sentence, maybe the most important one, the Congress shall not raise revenue or income in any other way, period. So that you focus it all in on one thing. Now, what would that do? It's very simple. I'll explain it. It's a flat tax of 40%, but very progressive. That is, that for every, what would be the same for every individual, from people who make nothing to people who make millions of dollars a year, is that the next dollar that they earned, they would have 60 cents more of disposable income. Because they're going to pay a 40% tax on that. But if they have no income, they're going to have a smaller subsidy than they would have. Let's say that the break-even point would be about $40,000. I think right now that's somewhere in that range. The break-even point would be about $40,000. And so if somebody makes no money at all, they would get 40% of the discrepancy, which would be $16,000, individual by individual. Now, it's very hard to figure out what would happen. Now, I'll explain that in a little while, and we don't have to worry about it. It's not going to happen. So the second thing is, if you made $10,000, then the discrepancy is $30,000. $40,000 is a break-even point, so the discrepancy is $30,000. You would get 40% of that, which would be a subsidy of $12,000. So you'd make 10, you'd get a subsidy of 12, your income would be $22,000. So the person who makes nothing would have 16, and you'd have 22. And the actual way that it works is very, very simple. For every dollar that you earn, you'd have 60 cents more of disposable income. And you moved right up to the break-even point, 40,000. You don't have to get a subsidy. You don't pay any tax. You have $40,000. Now you make $80,000, and you pay a tax of 40% of the excess over the break-even point. So 80,000 minus 40 is 40,000. You'd pay a tax of 16,000. 16,000 on 80 is a 20% tax rate. So the actual effective subsidy rate would be a curve that would very smoothly move up towards zero, and the tax rate, the effective tax rate, would be a smooth curve that would move up towards 40%. And you'd have to make about 20 times the break-even point before your actual tax rate would start being 39.5%, 39.6%, 39%. So very wealthy people, their income, their tax, would approach 40%. Now, what would be in it for them? Most of the time, they pay the most tax anyway. The top 10% pay the most in income tax anyway. And I'm talking about eliminating all the other forms of taxation. Well, first of all, there'd be no inheritance tax. Second of all, corporations are not taxed. All the assets that are in a corporation would not be taxed. And therefore, the only thing that would be taxed would be the money that you take from, that people take from corporations, from other organizations, and convert to their own personal use. Essentially, your personal income. That's what's taxed. And that you can control. How much you personally consume would be totally under your control. And that's one of the big advantages of a plan like this, would be that you would have an extreme incentive for people to delay gratification, to build up assets, to build up capital, because there's no taxation. And therefore, families could plan ahead without all the tax code and everything like that for developing assets, for developing, you know, family-controlled businesses or shares in other corporations and so on, so that they could build up the family wealth over a long period of time. Now, I have to say, as I said, that you can count on the fourth or fifth generation to kind of ruin that for you, but you don't have to worry about that if you only care about your children and your grandchildren. So that would be one element of what would take place, delaying the gratification. The other big incentive, which is built into the system, is that Congress would be under tremendous pressure to minimize its expenditures. Why? Because the only thing they can do every year is move that break-even point. It's $40,000 one year. They have to say, okay, well, in order to raise all the money, in order to pay for what the government does, the federal government does, plus redistribute everything that we have to do to redistribute to the people who don't make enough, we need to set the break-even point at $45,000, or we have to lower it to $35,000. We have to move it this way or that way. And everybody in the whole country wants the same thing from the Congress, which is to raise the break-even point. The rich people want the break-even point as high as possible. The poorest people want the break-even point as high as possible. In fact, that pressure is so extreme that you have to be very careful about not allowing the Congress to borrow from the future in order to keep raising the break-even point, which happens in large partnerships and other things. Sometimes people borrow for the future in order to keep everybody happy that's working, and it's basically what the United States government is doing right now, to borrow from the future in order to keep, you know, to solve problems that I think it can, which is another element of my idea, which I thought of about 30 years ago or so, and that is that you don't really know how many problems you can solve. How much can we afford of our problems to solve? There's an endless supply of problems that we will want to solve if we're humane. And we will want to solve those problems. But if you don't do it on a sound economic basis, you often create a bigger problem in the future than you solved in the present. The cure is worse than the disease, as I said. You know, and that's basically what happens when you really undercut by extreme borrowing from the future. What will happen to the future generations? Or will they be in the same situation? You've taken an institution, or if you take an institution, any institution, and you raiders, corporate raiders that look at certain institutions, they say, they have too much cash, I can use that cash better, I'm going to go in and take that over, and then they bleed all the cash out of the institution, leave the institution in its wake, and maybe they put that cash to better use, and maybe not. Maybe it's very hard to say what's a better use and what's not a better use, because even if you buy a yacht with it, for example, even that yacht, there's a lot of people that were at work building that yacht, and a lot of people making sure that the gas is there and pumping the gas out so that you can tool that yacht around the Mediterranean, and so on and so forth. And every place you go, all the food, everything, it's all an expense. It's all jobs for people. And it seems to me one of the things that we don't pay attention to is it's a great humanitarian task is to give other people something good to do with their lives, something useful, something productive to do with their lives. And I think that's another reason why institutional strength is a very, very, you know, basic idea for the economy. If people make more fundamentally sound economic decisions in those institutions because they're not distracted by tax laws that push them off in other directions, then you'll have much more sound basic economy. The other thing is if you take a certain percentage off the top of and bring it down to the bottom to spend, it goes to the basic goods and services. And therefore, you will have something. But you also have to kind of say, what's the percentage? What can we afford? What is it that we can do? How many problems can we solve without causing the cure to be worse than the disease? It's a very hard thing to decide. But I think basically you can look at it and say, as a percentage of the overall economy, you can spend this much without undercutting the incentives of all the other people to do their work to keep being productive. And 50% is a kind of threshold. And so if you make the 40% as the highest tax, and then you assume that the local taxation could be somewhere in the range of 5 to 10%, then you're going to keep it under 50%. Part of the rules I worked on 30 years ago was to say that the local taxation couldn't exceed the 10% that would, you know, bring it over the 50%. But at the same time that you're trying to figure that out, you also can say, well, the effect of just giving away the money to people on an individual-by-individual basis it might be very strange. People might get very lazy, for example. People say, well, geez, if I could get $16,000 a year and not do anything, that would be just great. Well, you could, for example, there's a lot of people that could have a great advantage from this, and it would also be a way of redoing programs like student loan programs, student aid programs. All those, if 18 years old is the majority age and you're a citizen at that point, and then you're available to get this money, then individually you would have that money. And you could use it to go to school, or you could use it to goof off, or you could use it to do both, which what most people do in college. And you could use that money for that period of time. Or you could goof off for a few years and at 25 go back to school at any point that you're willing to live like a student. You know, you could go back on that money. So that would be student aid, and you would just cut out all the other aid programs for students. Another element would be, you know, people say, well, you know, we want married couples to stay together. We want the family to be at home. We want one of the spouses to stay home and so on. And that's why we have this marital law in there, and we're trying to manipulate people to behave this way. Well, it's not that big of an incentive. But if one person doesn't work in a couple, they're also available. I mean, they could get the same subsidy. So maybe the wife is a doctor, and she pays $50,000 a year in taxes, and the husband stays home and gets the $16,000 subsidy. So it would be the same thing as just trying to adjust their taxes because they're married and one isn't working. But at least that way the husband would have a little bit of more power in the relationship. So every individual, if we treat every individual, by the way, this is a totally not tax policy idea, but if every individual is treated as an individual by the government as opposed to what kind of a union are you, what kind of an organization are you, then the whole marriage issue about who's married and who's not married and all the benefits would all disappear. Nobody would even have to discuss the subject because the government would be out of the marriage business. The government is only in the business of benefits and who gets benefits, you know, who's responsible for family benefits, for insurance benefits, everything, because during World War II there was wage and tax control on the government, on the corporations. They couldn't raise the wages, and so what they did was they started giving out these benefits for free. And that was popular, and it kept on, and so all these benefits are tax-free. There'd be absolutely no incentive and no allowance of that under a system that taxed whatever personal benefit you got out of something. That would be taxable. And therefore, nobody would do that. Everybody would just give cash because there's no reason to set up all these expensive programs and administer them when you have a simple way of doing it. But when the rules incentivize you to do it in a more complex way, we are going to do it in a more complex way. Absolutely. That's another element of part of the reaction. Another thing, another really large upcoming demographic problem, or not upcoming, it's been around for about 20 or 30 years now. What do we do with our unskilled labor in developed countries? What are we doing with our unskilled labor? We don't have work for them. I mean, there's a certain percentage that have work. But unskilled labor is so cheap outside the United States. It's very hard to see what we're going to do to make those people feel that they're making a contribution to our society. And if they don't feel that they're making a contribution, that is a very ineffective situation. I could use a much stronger word than that, but it's a very ineffective situation, both for them and for us. Now, I know it would be difficult to switch back to having no minimum wage. But if your minimum wage, if there was no minimum wage and someone offered you a job, you had no income, someone offered you a job for $2 an hour, doing something very simple like standing on a street corner handing out leaflets or something like that where you could listen to your music, and you know, there's a lot of jobs like that now, but if there was something that was very simple like that, people would be able to do it because they would have more income. $2 an hour, $6 an hour, $4 an hour. And if you change the rule, then the actual real minimum wage would start to be created, what people would be willing to work for. Well, that's not worth it to me to even stand outside if that's all you're going to give me, and they wouldn't do it. But at a certain point, you would find for each kind of labor, and then all kinds of things that are uneconomic would then be done. And so you would have a reason to have much closer to full employment. And in addition to that, if people were unemployed temporarily, they could go out and do something else at a lower wage for a while and then go back to their thing when they can. So there's a lot of problems with unskilled labor for the foreseeable future, 100, 200 years, because it probably will take that long for the wages to catch up throughout the whole world, if that ever happens. But it would get closer. Those of you who were from the Midwest were aware of the Rust Belt in the 60s and 70s, and what happened was, it's called the Rust Belt because the factories were running down and everything, and all of a sudden in the South, people started building car manufacturing plants because the wages were lower. And what happened? Within 15 years, the wages evened out between the North and the South. Now, that was easier to accomplish than what will happen worldwide. But the same sort of phenomenon will take place over a longer period of time. And when it does, people will be back to manufacturing closer to themselves. Because other costs being the same, you're going to try to avoid transportation costs, etc. And especially if energy goes up. Now, the one caveat that I wanted to say about this was the one thing that will make this unnecessary would be very cheap energy. If somebody comes up with a very cheap form of energy, then we will keep being able to be very productive, and we probably will be able to gloss over all the problems we're going to have to face in the next 50 years if we don't think about it. So there's a way to get around it. But how likely is that to happen? It's probably more likely to happen than that we're going to put in place a really good set of incentives for our social system. But still, it's not certain that it will happen. So I think it's really useful to think about these things. There are disadvantages, of course. One of the disadvantages is timing of payments. You know, people would have to get monthly payments, I'm sure, and you'd have to plan ahead, and there must be some, like, a borrowing account and stuff like that, but it's not at all insurmountable. Other problems would be the politicians would be very mad about the system because they'd only be able to do one thing, and that is to set the break-even point. And they wouldn't be able to collect a lot of money from anybody in order to influence that decision. That could spoil a big part of their party. And as a result, it may change the way the game is played. But when the game is played a certain way, certain people are attracted to it, to play that game. And if you change the way the game is played, you know, if you change the game, if you say that the national sport is baseball, then you attract certain people to play baseball. It's a certain kind of style of game. And if you say, no, the national sport is now hockey, having gone through football and on our way, now we're hockey, well, you know, it's a different style of play. And if the government in Washington is played like baseball is played or if it's played like hockey is played, that's a big difference. And people who like to play hockey will want to be in Washington if that's the way the game is played. People who want to play baseball will want to be in Washington if that's the way the game is played. It could be more genteel, probably still provide plenty of stories for all of us to be entertained by. So, that's some of the advantages and disadvantages. I'm sure you can think of more, and ask me any questions you want to about the idea. So I'll open it up to questions.
Yeah. Say you close down and totally eliminate some of the more minor programs like the military. Would your proposal be able to fund some of the mandates such as Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and the deficits they've run up?
Well, I think that'd be the first thing that one would have to plan the break-even point based upon. I think the thing to be done, if it was ever done, as I told you, I have no hope whatsoever that a plan like this would be put in place. But the Social Security system, we're going to face a problem with it, you know, in 20 or 30 years. No problem at all, no issue at all. And the inflation that probably will take place because of the excessive borrowing will, if they play with the numbers, I wouldn't ever suggest that the government would do such a thing. But if they play with the numbers, basically they're going to have to do something, and we probably won't notice that strongly, but they're going to have to lower the purchasing power of those Social Security payments, probably by half or something like that, to make it work with fewer workers and so many older people. Think, well, how else are they going to make that work? But my attitude towards it is very simple. Social Security was a great idea, but, you know, any idea that keeps building up over time is very hard to keep it running when it is a growth industry. And there is no growth to support the growth industry. That's why I say that what can we afford along this line? Well, what we can afford is we can distribute to everybody who has no income this money that I say. And 16,000 isn't all that much different than it is real difference in money, but there's no way of knowing whether the break-even point would be 40,000 or 50,000. And another thing I wanted to say is that if the society became very wealthy, they might lower the 40% to 30% or 35 or anything in between. That could be done as well, because you might not want, you know, people getting $50,000 of purchasing power without working, for example, if the society got really wealthy. But that's a problem that probably won't be reached. But I would take away the Social Security and the Medicare programs, because I think it's going to break us. I think it's going to break our economy. It might be 30 or 40 years from now.
But would your plan be able to afford it?
To get rid of it?
Would it be able to afford to pay those things?
No, I don't think so. What it would be able to do is to pay everybody who has no income. But to pay all the people who have enough income, their Social Security. I mean, I understand that that's like saying, well, we promised you this for all these years, but you can just look at that other $10,000 that you paid in taxes a year as part of all the other taxes that you paid. There's no real guarantee, and I think the same thing is going to be even truer on a bigger scale. All the pension funds that have been promised by governments, by local governments, because, I mean, right now people are starting to yell about it because it's clear that there's going to be a problem, but 15 or 20 years from now, you know, the governments, it won't be just a couple of communities that go bankrupt like Vallejo. And there will be no way. The promises are way in excess of what can be raised. And something has to be done. Something has to give. It'd be great if you could get all the players to sit down in a room and say, okay, we're going to take half, you take half, you take half of what you said, and that's where we're going. We're all going to half. But it'll never happen. It'll be much more disruptive than that. And that's why I think...
Like Greece?
Well, I'm hoping it's not going to be like Greece, and I hope it's not going to be like Russia when they lost the value of their money altogether in 98. You know, when all the pensioners in Russia under the communist system was supposed to be at least security for everybody. You know, and therefore, we have a lot of inefficiencies in our system in order that everybody is secure. But what happened was that all those pensioners, when they got to old age, lost everything. They had no income left at all, and they had no money left in the bank because the ruble went to zero. I mean, that's you know, the worst-case scenario. It certainly has happened plenty of times. And what I'm saying is it's not going to be that bad. I don't think that the United States is going to run into that situation. I'm not a doomsayer at all. I'm a very optimistic person about how we can do things, or I wouldn't spend time thinking about how can you do this better. But there's going to be a real crunch on the incentives here and a crunch on the facts in all the pensions, because you've got this huge baby boom and you haven't got as big a group of people working. And it's going to be worse outside of the United States, in Europe and Japan, because the United States has an immigration issue. People call it a problem. But we have immigration that brings in a lot more younger people, and that they work, and their working is going to help supply at least some of the problem for Social Security. More people will support the older people than they have per person than they're going to have in either Japan or Europe. So they're going to have to run down their assets in Japan and Europe a little bit in order to do this. And, of course, there's nothing wrong with that. And that's what assets are built up for. But I think the transition could be fairly smooth, and it could be, you know, fairly, but we're going to have to figure out that everybody can have a 20-room, you know, a 12,000-square-foot home, and that, you know, everybody's going to be able to live like that. It's not going to happen. And it's not even necessarily fun to do that. So I think some adjustment's going to have to be made. Don't know how it'll be. Now, you said about the military. I think the military is the one of the things that the government will definitely spend its money on. But it will be harder pressed to say, we're going to lower the break-even point from 40,000 to 35,000 next year so that we can wage a war, because that's what they'd have to do. You'd have a lot, you know, it wouldn't be an 80% approval rating when someone shouts war under those circumstances, would it? Because everybody would feel it. And also, everybody would feel, you know, that what's a fact, which is that the people who are very productive and wealthy are the economic driver of the whole country, and they pay the bill for the whole country. Because when things were going well for the economy, the break-even point would go up. And the poor people, not all of them, because, of course, they wouldn't think about it this way, and they would still be jealous and everything, but if they thought about it, and there would be people that would be telling them, look, those people are working that hard, and because they're working and are being successful, the break-even point is going up, and you're all going to get more money next year. It would influence the feelings. It wouldn't change the total human dynamic, of course, but it would influence the feelings on both the war issue and on the poverty issue versus the people who are being you can say hard workers, or you can say they inherited the money and they're using it well, or I mean, all kinds of things. There's a wide variety of productivity and lack of productivity in every single group of the economy. But the fact is the top 20% pay most of the taxes to run the federal government, and that'll always be true, and it'll be true under my system as well. So, and I think it just makes a clearer deal for the top 20%. Because the deal is very clear. You can keep your assets, you pay us 40%, and you won't be thrown in jail, on your income. Everything that you convert to personal use, you have your choice. Do you want to live so that all the neighbors think that you're wealthy, or do you want to save your assets? You know, I mean, your choice. Whatever you do, and it'd be pretty easy, you know, of course, under that system. Whatever you convert to personal consumption is your wealth. If somebody's living beyond their means, you know, the Internal Revenue Service will be interested, as they always have. Well, because, you know, and if somebody has five Social Security numbers in order to collect five subsidies, it's theft. You know. If they called it theft, that would be great, instead of conversion or all those other names that make it sound a little more polite. Avoiding taxes. Other question?
I had a question, not about your tax.
Yeah.
I had a more basic question when you were talking about the estate tax. Uh-huh. It's been my understanding, and I just wanted to clarify it, that if you, with all your hundreds of thousands or millions, put your money into trust funds or revocable trusts, that you basically avoided the issue with estate taxes.
The trust becomes taxable.
Yeah. I'll give it to a tax lawyer.
The trust is another taxable entity, like a corporation or an individual or something. So, no, that wouldn't work to completely avoid all taxes. It might take you out of estate taxes, but you'd be paying, and it's very hard to shelter income in a trust with deductions that individuals can do, or corporations or estates for that. You pay the fixed amount of tax on trust income, and there's no way to get out of it.
Yeah, and the reason for it that people do that is to avoid probate, to avoid the court, and to not have a year's delay and a bunch of fees and stuff like that. That's what they're trying to avoid more than taxation. So it's not, you know, and that's another thing, that all of the skills and talents that are aimed at all of that avoidance would also disappear under my system. And one of the things that I think is really valuable, actually, more valuable than any of the other parts of the system, is that elimination of what amounts to make work, so that people can do real work, really more productive work. Now, I'm not saying anything was wrong about that's the incentive, that's the system, you go out there and do it. It's like, you know, if you're an ambitious person, and this is true for almost any culture, you're an ambitious person growing up in a culture, you look around yourself as a teenager, usually. You don't usually notice before that, although some people do. And you look around and say, what is rewarded in this system? How am I going to be a player in this system? And then you go for it. And if to be a player in the system means that you learn to play basketball really well, that's what you do. And if it means being a drug lord, that's what you do. And if it means joining, you know, the mafia, that's what you do. And if it means... you know, being a economic, productive, honest member of a democratic society, that's what you do. But rarely is that the choice. And that's the choice that makes all the difference in the world as to how people, you know, behave. Another element, you mentioned the military before. You know, the military is another culture that has its own set of incentives. And, you know, the military has often relied upon a very, very strong honor code to develop the most noble form of violent destruction of other people and other things as can be done. And it makes a big difference. I don't mean that facetiously. If you go to Europe, why did Germany cooperate with the United States against the Soviet Union after World War II? Why did they, I mean, not just the Marshall Plan, why did they go along with us? Why did they do that?
They didn't
want to get butchered. That's not the only reason. What did our military do when it took over that country? It was fairly genteel, relatively speaking. It did not destroy the women, which the Russian army did. It did not destroy the wives and daughters. And it didn't destroy, I mean, it did plenty of destruction. There's Dresden, all that kind of stuff. I'm not saying we didn't destroy it, but we were fighting a war for a good reason. But once the war was over, there was a decision made that the population was not going to be considered the enemy. And before the war was over, the U.S. military men, on average, certainly not everybody, but on average, conducted themselves way above what other conquering armies have done. As a result, there was a tremendous amount of goodwill, and we can work with these people who just conquered us. Same thing in Japan. Not the same degree, but also to some degree. Because now, if the military loses that and is known as just another conquering force and behaves that way, you don't have any of that goodwill that you could have created. And that's obviously winning the hearts and minds, as they always say. Well, you know, when people say about winning the hearts and minds now, they try to bring out a PR person. Let's go win the hearts and minds with some good PR. You don't need PR. You need good behavior. That's what you need. That's an aside. So, yes, Don.
Does your system have a means of influencing behavior? In other words, when we want to influence behavior, we give tax credits or other things now.
No, I try to eliminate all that. And actually, one of the reasons that I do that, for example, I would have no mortgage deduction and all that. Now, it would be very tough to go from a transition from the way things are done to this. That's why I say, you know, it's not for being put in place. It's for thinking about things. And if things are really fall apart, you could put it in place and get a good system out of it. But, you know, because you wouldn't want to change all the values, the prices of all the homes, which you would do if you change that. But it's very important, I think, in a democracy to not act like a monarch, telling people what to do. People should be as free as possible to pursue it. And I think also when you judge your economy, especially if we're going to have a low or no growth or even negative growth economy based on our population, that people should be allowed to pursue their economic lives the way they want to and not, you know, everybody has to get as much money as possible in order to be happy, because that's not the way it works, as we all know. And so I wouldn't care if the GDP went up or down. I wouldn't care if the break-even point went up or down, as long as everybody was freer to make their own decisions about what it is. And another element of that, of course, is treat everybody individually. People who are stuck economically in relationships that they don't like but are afraid of leaving also would be freed up to make a different decision as well. I think it would make everything freer, and people are not ready for that in a way. People like to have control over lots of other people. And ironically, you know, part of my psychological theory that parts is based on, because this is my idea is based on a personality approach towards humanity. I look at the I have just enough time for this probably. I look at the human race this way. If you and I think that in a democracy we should not aim at just satisfying a small group of people and make them satisfied. I think you should aim at trying to satisfy as many people as possible. So if you look at the personality curve of humanity, it's like a bell curve. Okay? It's like a bell curve. And in the middle, where most people are generally intelligent, so somewhat street smart, you know, not dumb, can do math, can read, so on and so forth. All people can be trained to do all those things. And they are caught up in a large number of things that are in their immediate interest. They're not interested in theory. They're not interested in ideas. They're interested in having fun, enjoying their families, so on. There's absolutely nothing wrong with this form of life. At the other end of the spectrum, at the low end of the spectrum, are psychopaths, serial killers, you know, people who have no feeling for other people at all. They think, I'll go to that. And at the other end of the spectrum is all the people who have spent their time trying to make the human race better, one way or the other. Okay. Now, you take that whole spectrum, and what's interesting to me is how each of those parts of the spectrum looks at the human race. If you take the psychopaths and the killers and you ask them, what do they think of the human race? What do they say? They say they're a bunch of idiots and fools. They're too good. They shouldn't be that good. It's a dog-eat-dog world. They just don't understand that. Right? And they act accordingly. because that's their way of looking at things. And you go into the middle. No, Mr. Average Joe from Dubuque, Iowa. No. And you ask that person, what do they think of their neighbors? And they say, everybody's pretty all right. You know, I mean, people are good. I mean, you know, this guy cheats at cards. That guy's cheated on his wife. But, you know, not too often. and so on and so forth. And so, you know, it's like, you know, it's like how people reacted to Bill Clinton, you know, when he was caught cheating. You know, Bill Clinton was a very clever politician. Okay. First, he said, you know, he said all kinds of things. I won't go into what he said. But I happened to go to Richmond, Virginia, right after the Monica Lewinsky talk on TV with one of the women, Barbara Walters probably, interviewed her, right? And so I get down there the day after that interview, and a 55-year-old African-American taxi driver, you know, picks me up at the airport and is going to take me to my meeting. And one of the first things he says is, boy, did you see Monica last night? And I said, well, you know, I caught about 5 minutes of it at about 10:30 at night when I got home, you know, on tape. He says, oh, man, he said, those lips. You know, and that's all he took away from her interview was those lips. He said, you know, and I have my own Monica Lewinsky. He explained he had somebody out in the countryside that was his Monica Lewinsky. And, you know, I thought right away that, you know, when Bill Clinton confessed, you know, he was winking at a large part of the group of people that support him and that supported him during that time, he was winking at them saying, hey, if you were president, what would you have done? You know, and for most of the guys, they all knew exactly what they would have done, and they didn't blame him. And that's why he was able to stay. I mean, it was the way he dealt. I mean, first he denied, and then, oh, yeah, you caught me, okay? And then let's get on with things. And he that was a gifted approach to trying to deal with his problem that he had gotten himself into. But, you know, these guys don't think badly of him for that. They would think he was a fool if he hadn't done it. And actually, you know, most of the presidents were not fools along that line. They mostly did the same thing. So basically, you know, the people in that group, they're looking at humanity and they think it's good. Now, what's interesting is that when you go to the end of the people who, all the people, all the top religious leaders, all the top philosophers, all the top scientists, everybody who's spending a lot of time trying to improve the human race, what do they think of the human race? Not too much. They also think they're idiots, but for different reasons, just like the psychopaths. They think, you really need to reform. I don't know how you can even stand your lives. You know, you don't know what you're doing. You know, you make all these decisions that are not in your own self-interest. Let me give you a rule. Let me give you 10 steps. Can you follow 10 steps? Let me give you 10 steps, and then you can be better. I think one of the most perfect examples of having a bad set of incentives that will cause problems for thousands of years afterwards because people are trying to follow those incentives in their own way is the Ten Commandments. Now, you have taken a lot of things that people necessarily aren't that interested in, and you've made them very interesting because you've forbidden them. And once you forbid them, all the people with free will say, geez, you can't stop my free will like that. I want to do that. Don't tell me it's not forbidden. And I'll end with a quote from Mark Twain on that one. He said one of the most insightful things about our Adam and Eve myth of anybody. He said, Adam was only human. He didn't want the apple because he wanted to eat an apple. He wanted to eat the apple because it was forbidden. The mistake lay in not forbidding him to eat the snake. And that's why we got to get the incentives right. Well, thank you very much.